thing they were curious about. So I'll answer that before I get into what I have tonight. There are a lot of people that are concerned about the possibility of a terrorist attack, and some of the various types of viruses or chemical pollutants killing us or affecting us, making us sick. I don't think we have a thing in the world to worry about here in Dardanelle. I'd give you 100% reliability factor on that. Now, when I was in the agency, because I was a meteorologist and because they needed meteorology in all sections one way or the other, I got to go from compartment to compartment, which is very unusual in the agency because they compartmentalize each little unit so nobody else will know what's happening. Now, one of the units that I serviced was whenever they were contemplating the possibility of a thermonuclear blast, they would get me to draw them up what's known as an atomic fallout plot. And you take the winds from the surface up to as far as you can get them, maybe 30, 40,000 feet. And then you do a plot that shows at each level where the different things involved, beta particles, alpha particles from bombs will fly. This was part of my training. And so now the one section of the agency that is super, super secret involves chemical and biological warfare. So I had very limited contact with them. And so I don't know a whole lot about them, but they also use plots in case a bomb was to explode, and then where would the different contaminants go the first hour, second hour, third hour, fourth hour, fifth hour. We had to do them out for 12 hours where they would go. So I know a little bit about chemical and biological elements. I don't know a whole lot, but I do know some things about them, and some of the things I know are pretty factual. The things I'm going to talk about are the factual things. If they are going to use them in this country, they would use them in an area to affect a large city. And the fact that they found the manual in one of the terrorist belongings that had drawings of the inside of a Boeing aircraft in the pilot's compartment, and the fact that they were connected with crop dusting planes gave the investigators good reason to believe that they might have considered that. Well, if they did, and I think they probably did, first of all, I don't think now they're going to have time for that. They're going to be on the run backwards, forwards, and sideways, and I don't look for any mass thing like they had up in New York to be carried out in this country. Maybe never again, and certainly not for a long time. But if they had started doing that first, before they did this thing in New York, that might have been the big thing that happened that might have killed a lot of people. Now, the only thing we have in this country so far that has indicated what they might use would be crop dusters. Well, all terrorist groups want to have the maximum effect, kill as many people as possible in any engagement, any espionage act that they carry out. So they would pick a place that had a lot of crop dusting equipment and planes and pilots. It would have to be way over in eastern Arkansas if they did it in Arkansas. And I don't think they would do it in Arkansas at all. Little Rock is a fairly nice sized city, and if I'm wrong, they would do it in Little Rock, and I don't think it would affect us up here. The smallpox vaccine, when I was a boy, it made you sick. I remember my arms just swelled up double, but finally, they just stopped having smallpox. So it's very hard to get the smallpox vaccine. They run very tight controls on these things in the countries that do have them, and there aren't a lot of countries that have them, and they run a pretty tight control on bubonic plague virus. As far as anthrax is concerned, there's a possibility, as a matter of fact, I think he does have. Saddam Hussein has anthrax. But if you're going to see these different types of dangerous elements released in the atmosphere, you're going to see them in a large city. I don't think we have a thing in the world to worry about here at Dardanelle at all. Now, out around Dallas, they have a lot of farmland. They do a lot of crop dusting. So Dallas would be a good city to hit. Up around Kansas City, they have a lot of farming, a lot of crop. That would be a good city to hit. up in the Midwest and through there. They also do some crop dusting. And they would hit a major city up there. Now, I realize that I'm not saying, you know, I hope they hit them up there. I'm just saying, I don't think we've got anything to worry about. And if you want to be honest about it, that's mostly what we're interested in, how it's going to affect us. So I don't think we have a thing in the world to worry about here in this area, in Darnell, Arkansas, or in Yell County, or Pope County, or anywhere around here. These things, it's why haven't the terrorists used them before? I think some of the terrorist groups have a limited access to some of them, probably actually possess them. But you see, if Osama bin Laden had used these things, man, that's just what you need to wipe out the terrorist. They stay in caves and hide in rough mountain terrain, and these areas are sparsely populated, very few people in them. If they had used some type of poisonous gas in this thing, they wanted to kill a lot of people, we would already have been pelting those hills of Afghanistan with it, because turnabout's fair play. And so that's one of the reasons you don't ever hear about it being used. A lot of people have been curious, well, how come if they hate Israel so much, why don't they use it on them? Because the Israelis have chemical and biological poisons like you would not believe. They also have thermonuclear weapons. They have a hydrogen bomb. They have several. And they have nuclear warheads on a lot of their Jericho missiles down in the Negev. The people of that area all know that. If I tell you, there are two wild cards that bother me, and only two. Saddam Hussein is completely unpredictable. And he has illusions of grandeur. He actually has dreams about himself riding into Jerusalem on a white horse like Saladin, who was the great liberator that ran the Crusaders out back in the times of the Crusades, and finally drove the French. And I think 1351, they were the last ones, I think he drove them off where we now have Caesarea. And he's crazy. And there's no telling what that man might do. I'm very anxious for him to bite the bullet, because most of these leaders are fairly predictable. They value their own countrymen because that's who they rule over, and they don't want to die themselves. The other one is Osama bin Laden. He's another loony. And he doesn't care what happens to anybody, probably including himself. So they're unpredictable. I'll be real happy when they get Osama bin Laden, and I think they will. One way or the other, as George Bush says, dead or alive. And I'll be real glad when somebody takes Saddam Hussein out, because those two are crazy. But even though they're unpredictable, I don't think we've got a thing in the world to worry about here in the Arkansas River Valley. Now, if I lived over around Dallas, I wouldn't worry about it, because don't think anybody in this country's got anything to worry about, because this is not something you can do on a mass level. The smallpox vaccine now, they're starting to increase it. It'll take a while, but a lot of these horrible diseases people talk about, at the time that they had them, they were terrible. But now, with modern-day medicine, most of them, if you catch them early, you can stop them. They're anthrax is that way. You have to catch them early. But I'm not worried about the chemical and biological aspect of it, and I'm not worried about the thermonuclear side of it. I just wish this whole thing gets started, because, like I say, I've never been so happy in my life. The end of the world's here. And most people think you're crazy when you say something like that. Now, I've been touting this for a long time, telling you I was convinced a false peace will come. At the same time that I've been doing this for many years, I've used the expression constantly, off again, on again, gone again, thin again. I told people when I started doing these lectures 21 years ago, I said, do not look for this false peace to come anytime soon. I said, it's going to be off again, on again, gone again, thin again. Palestinians will do something bad. The Israelis will do something bad back. The Palestinians will do something worse. I've told people for 21 years, do not look for this to happen very soon. Well, I'm telling you now, I think it's going to happen pretty soon. I told you why. I told you because of this terrorist act that was performed in New York and Pennsylvania and in Washington, D.C. I told you that it was going to be successful. This terrorist thing will be successful. We won't completely eliminate them, but we're sure going to put them on the run. And with them on the run, it takes away the element that Yasser Arafat and Rafsanjani and Bashar Assad and Saddam Hussein, and all the different, Muammar Gaddafi, all the men who rule these countries that sponsor these terrorist organizations, they're going to make them ineffective. Their main goal has always been to drive Israel completely out of all of Israel. They're going to change their motivation. The United States doesn't want any more of these terrorist attacks. Who would? And I told you, and I preached it very clearly and concisely on Sunday morning, two Sundays ago, that I expected the end result on down the line would be a peace treaty. Because that's the way to stop this terrorist activity, is to get a peace treaty. And I think it's going to be a false peace, because I believe these same countries that have been sponsoring these terrorists are going to get together behind closed doors and secret meetings and not vent their hatred for us openly, but get the terrorists off our back by promising them that very shortly they'll have a jihad, a holy war, and that'll get the terrorists calmed down for a while. In Ezekiel 38, 9 through 11, I covered this. Matter of fact, I've preached on it several times. Ezekiel 38, 9 through 11. Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands, and many people with thee. This is when the Antichrist comes down from the north. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. Now you've got to realize, when this was written in 600 B.C., that at that time he's going to paint a picture, a scenario, of what it would be like for people to be at peace in that time. He just tells you, peace is coming. Now, you can't say that that's like this way now, because we generally have unwalled villages. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, and having neither bars nor gates. In other words, the attack will come against a people that think they are at peace with their enemy, and then their enemy will attack. And I've covered this many times in 1 Thessalonians 5, 3, and 4, and I've covered it in intricate detail. I've gone back and showed you all the scriptures where Paul wished himself to be accursed, where he wished to himself to be accursed that all Israel might be saved. And when he says they in verse 3, 1 Thessalonians 5, 3, he's talking about unbelieving Israel. Of course, in our day and time, it would apply to all unbelievers. For when they, in this case primarily Israel, shall say peace and safety, then sudden destruction cometh upon them as travail upon a woman with a child, and they shall not escape. But ye, he may as plural brethren, members of the church at Thessalonica, to whom this was written, are not in darkness, if that day should overtake you as a thief. And quite frankly, it's not going to overtake us as a thief. Now, I believe that before next year is over, you will have a peace agreement in place between the Palestinians, Israel, and Syria. And I believe the terrorist groups will lay off and not do anything, because they will be promised by the leaders of these fanatical Arabs, like Rafsanjani in Iran, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, Bashar Assad up in Syria, and Muammar Gaddafi over in Libya. All the extremist leaders will get together behind closed doors. They've already done it once. And they're going to be plotting a surprise attack against Israel, and the terrorist groups will be a part of all this. They'll be there at the meetings. And they'll hold them off by promising them that within a short period of time, after they lure Israel into a false sense of security, then they will launch a blitzkrieg-type offensive, just like Hitler launched through the Low Countries, to get around the Maginot Line and attacked France and overrun her in a matter of days. Now, Peres, Arafat agree on measures. The long-awaited meeting between Shimon Peres, Israel's foreign minister, and Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, ended on Wednesday with an agreement that the two sides would resume security cooperation with immediate effect. The joint statement endorsed a series of steps designed to turn the fragile week-long truce into a more permanent ceasefire. Hamas, this is one of the terrorist groups operating out of Lebanon, Hamas offers to suspend bombings in original borders. Now, am I telling you this is peace now? This is it? No, not by any stretch of the imagination. They'll break this one. They'll have another intifada, a little skimmish. Then they'll have a couple more. It's going to be off again, on again, gone again, thin again. But for the first time, I'm telling you that by the middle of next year, I expect them to have a peace agreement and a false peace established. And I believe that that is going to be something that, if you're going to worry about the end times coming, then you better start worrying when peace comes, because it's the calm before the storm. Now, Gaza City, Gaza.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat plan to meet today to seek an end to the violence that has claimed more than 700 lives, and the militant Islamic Hamas is offering to suspend suicide bombings in Israel in a tentative truce. In his first interview on Palestinian TV since fighting erupted, Peres said Tuesday that the meeting was prepared properly, in my view, and is being held in an atmosphere of agreement between the two sides. Palestinian people are fed up with the peace process, said Abba Shanab. But the Bush administration is trying to push both sides to restart peace negotiations to help it solidify its alliance against Afghanistan's Taliban regime with Arab governments, which are demanding that the United States be more active in trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If you'll listen to the tapes, or if you remember the messages I preached, I told you that this terrorist act, as a direct result, would actually lead to the United States taking a more active role in getting the Palestinians and Israelis together. I told you it would cause the U.S. to put more pressure on, and it is. Behind the scenes, I guarantee you, it is. The question for the Americans is, will they force the Israelis to do what they are unwilling to do, to stop oppressing our people and occupying our land? Right now, we live in a prison. This isn't going to happen overnight. It's going to take several months. You're going to have some more off again, on again, gone again. Like I've said many times, the Palestinians will say, that's it, we don't want to talk anymore. Syrians say, we don't want to talk anymore. Israelis say, kill them all. And finally, I believe by the middle of next year, you'll have a peace treaty in place. Now, we've been going through the book of Ezekiel from chapter 37 onwards, and several weeks ago we started with chapter 37, verse 1. We've been all the way through 37, and we've been leading up to a battle. Now, I'm going to stay in this 38th chapter for a little while, but this battle in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel is not a battle, it's a war. It's a war that lasts 3.5 years, during which most of that time Israel is trapped in the Negev wilderness. It's a war that has a final battle in it. The Civil War had a final battle in it. Every war has some final battle somewhere. So the Battle of Armageddon is the final battle in the War of Gog and Magog, which begins to start the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period, and ends with the coming of Jesus. In Revelation 16, 16, final battle in the war of Gog and Magog. And they gather them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. It's called Armageddon. It's called the Tell of Megiddo. It's an ancient city that sits where the plain of Ezra Elon comes down and meets the plain of Jezreel. And it sits right in the middle. It's a long northwest-southeast valley. And it's in this place that the Antichrist troops, a large number of them, will be quartered and waiting to pounce on Israel as a sort of a back force that's coming down. Actually, they'll be all the way down the Jordan. They'll be actually in the valley of Jehoshaphat. And they'll be there primed for the final battle. But the actual initial attack in this is what I'm concerned about, because it occurs about 3.5 years before this. Now we're going to take a look at Matthew 23:39. Jesus said, "For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." He's talking about the time that he returns. He ascended on the Mount of Olives, ascended into heaven, and he's been our lawyer, our advocate, our high priest with God, and he's been there forgiving our sins, all those who are believers, and he's been there directing from heaven what goes on this planet, and he lives in the hearts of individual men and women. Now, he's coming back at the end. When he comes back to end the Battle of Armageddon. I personally believe that somewhere right about in here, he's going to come back and catch out all the saints and then bring them back with him. Nobody can be sure precisely when the rapture will occur. It's one of the most difficult things to really honestly say, I'm positive this is correct. We do know he's coming back at the end with all the saints. That's very easy to predict, not the time of it, but that it will happen. And the rapture itself is somewhere back in here. He comes back with all the saints at his second coming. Now, notice, he says, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Now we're going to take a look at Ezekiel 39, 1 through 8. I've got a mistake up there at the top. That should be Ezekiel 39, 1 through 8. In Ezekiel chapter 39, verses 1 through 8. No, let's see. Yeah. Have I got that right or have I got that wrong? Let me look back here. I noticed there's a hat. Yeah, this is Ezekiel 39. Ezekiel 39, 1 through 8. And I notice I've got a hyphen in there I'll have to take out. Therefore, thou son of man, prophesy against Gog, and say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. I spent a lot of time on Sunday school on Sunday mornings proving where Meshach and Tubal were settled, the descendants of the ones who came down off the ark, Noah, his wife, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and these are two of their descendants. And it's basically Syria, Lebanon, extreme southern Turkey, and extreme northwestern Iraq. That's where these people were settled in 600 B.C. Now, this is the final battle of Armageddon. This is when the Antichrist really gets zapped by the return of the Lord. He says, and I will turn thee back and leave but the sixth part of thee. So apparently only one-sixth of the Antichrist army will survive. Five-sixths will be destroyed and will cause thee to come up from the north parts. At the time that this was written, in the mind of the people in 600 B.C. who were living at the time of Ezekiel, this was what we call today Syria and Lebanon, the north parts. And I will bring thee upon the mountains of Israel, and I will smite thy bow out of thy left hand, and will cause thine arrows to fall out of thy right hand. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds of every sort, and to the beast of the field to be devoured. Thou shalt fall upon the open field, for I have spoken it, and I will send a fire on Magog. Magog is what we call the Soviet Union today, especially the southern flank of it. And among them that dwell carelessly in the isles. Now, I think when Ezekiel wrote this, he had in mind the isles that were out in the Mediterranean. It might not be wrong to extend it to all the nations all over the world today, but I think what he had in mind when he wrote it were the islands of the Mediterranean. However, it certainly could be extended to cover all the Gentile nations that are spread across the earth if a man wanted to. And they shall know that I am the Lord. So will I make my holy name known in the midst of my people Israel, and I will not let them pollute my holy name anymore, and the heathen shall know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel. He's going to use what he himself made in the landscape of Israel in planting two very deep cracks on both sides of the Jordan River Valley. He's going to rip that open like a ripe watermelon and create a flood basalt plain. How sure am I of that? I'm sure enough to teach it. And could I be wrong? Sure. But I'll tell you one thing, before I teach something, I have got to find rest in my own soul between myself and God, and God hasn't bothered me about this at all. When this thing rips open, it's going to create a raging flood basalt plain, 185 miles or 1,600 furlongs. It's going to go all the way up that Jordan Valley until it reaches the place where the plain of Esther Elon and the plain of Jezreel come into the Jordan Valley. God's going to shake the earth to its very foundations. I think that's how he's going to send a fire on Magog. I don't think that's thermonuclear fire. I believe that's fire out of the earth itself by some of these cracks that run up into the Soviet Union itself. I believe God's going to show the whole world that he's God. And I would say that truly, and the heathen, all non-Israelis, shall know that I am the Lord, the Holy One in Israel. We're on the very verge of this happening. Preachers have said it for so long, nobody pays much attention anymore. Do I mind that? Well, I suppose when I was a younger minister, I would have. I don't anymore. Matter of fact, I've gotten to the point where I really don't care whether anybody believes me or not. That's hard to say and mean, but I have. I've just finally gotten to the point where as long as I'm satisfied that I'm doing what God wants, the rest of the world's just going to have to worry about itself. Temple leveled. It's coming and age ends. Prophecy that I'm dealing with primarily began a long time ago. It began all the way back when the Lord told the nation of Israel that because they had rejected him, because they had rejected the prophets that were sent before him, that their temple, their house, was going to be left unto them desolate. This was Herod's temple. Sure enough, some 40 years after that prophecy was uttered, Titus came down with a Roman legion. It had been made spiritually desolate by God's Son before then, 40 years before, when he had refused to accept any more of the sacrifice because he himself became the sacrifice on the cross. And then 40 years later, sure enough, they came down and made it desolate materially and physically also. He said, "For I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." That's really talking about this coming when he comes back with the saints. It's really talking about when he comes back to this earth and he brings the saints with him. Because he's speaking this to his people. He was a Jew, and he was a real, full-blooded, legitimate Jew. And when he uses this expression, he's talking to the Jews. And immediately after he told them this, he didn't stop. In the Hebrew Bible, they don't divide it into chapters like we do. In the Hebrew Bible, we do Matthew 23, 38, 39, and then we go into a new chapter, chapter 24, and start with 1, 2, 3, 4, so forth, so on. Well, the Hebrew Bible just keeps right on going. This is all the same discourse. So notice what Jesus did. First, he told them the temple was going to be destroyed. It was destroyed spiritually with his crucifixion and physically some 40 years later. Then he tells them in verse 39, "For I say unto you, his own people, you shall not see me henceforth till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." That's the expression that they use at the Feast of Tabernacles when they expect his joyous time associated with the Messiah's coming. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple. He left the temple. And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. Herod's temple was a beautiful edifice, most magnificent structure. And Jesus said unto them, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." That prophecy was fulfilled some 40 years later, at the end of that generation, when Titus came down with the Roman legion and destroyed it. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, the first New Testament church, "Tell us, when shall these things be?" That, of course, is the first question. They said, "When is the temple going to be destroyed?" Jesus answered the question. But they asked him a second question before he answered it. "And what shall be the sign of thy coming?" They said, "When are you going to proclaim yourself as Messiah, as king, and take over?" Then the third question they asked him was, "And of the end of the world, when is this age going to end, all these kingdoms here be replaced, and there be one kingdom, your kingdom?" So they asked him three questions. And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no man deceive you. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences, loimos, deadly infectious disorders, and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows." The God-breathed word for loimos is any deadly infectious disorder, which includes, of course, AIDS. AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, HIV, is the only infectious disorder that we have had in history that has continuously gone and never declined and keeps on climbing, and for which we have found absolutely no cure whatsoever. When will the temple be leveled? That was the first question. What signs will pre-herald your coming when you come as king? And three, what signs herald the age ending, the actual end of this age that we're in? When is that going to end so that all these other kingdoms will be replaced by yours? Now, he used the word Odin for sorrows. All these, speaking of famines, pestilences, and earthquakes, are the beginning of sorrows. It means the birth pangs of a woman in travail. And as I've told you many times, those men to whom he spoke these words, and Jesus himself certainly knew, the pain that a Hebrew woman endured in childbirth. They didn't have painkillers. They chewed on some kind of roots that helped somewhat. They didn't have cesarean operations. They didn't have saddle blocks. They didn't have hospitals. They had the babies right there in their tents or in mud huts. And midwives, if they were lucky, came and delivered them. If a baby got caught crosswise, the woman died in childbirth. And these are horrifying pains even when the baby comes naturally and you have a large pelvis. But when you have a small pelvis and the baby cannot come out and you die in childbirth, that's twice as bad as what you have when the baby does come out normally. They knew what this word meant, Odin. And so the Lord indicated that the earthquakes would start increasing like a woman's birth pangs. He indicated that pestilence would start increasing like a woman's birth pangs. And he indicated that famines would do the same. So these things have been happening for a very long period of time. Now, we've been in a period of time known as the beginning of sorrows, which were the pre-heralding signs of Jesus' coming. Earthquakes, famines, and pestilences have all three been increasing like a woman's birth pangs for some considerable period of time. At the end of the beginning of sorrows, there is to be a period of false peace. I don't think it'll be as long as a lot of people think. I think it'll be a fairly short duration. That is to be followed by the last 3.5 years of the tribulation period. The actual war starts right about here, and it lasts for about 3.5 years and ends right about here. This last 3.5 years of tribulation is the war of Gog and Magog. The last battle in it right here, to which Christ returns and ends it himself, returning with all the saints from heaven, destroying 5/6 of the Antichrist army, occurs right here. And then he comes and begins his millennial reign on this earth for 1,000 years. I think we're very close to the time of that coming. Now, I don't mean next week. I think within 7 years it will occur. When will the temple be leveled? That was the first question that they asked him. Now, he answered it. He said, when will the temple be leveled? This discourse is covered in 3 different gospels. It's called the Olivet Discourse. It's covered in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We're going to answer his questions continuously in one single gospel, Luke, which has it in perfect chronological order, and it's much easier to follow. When will the temple be leveled? Luke 21:20. And when ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. It is completely and utterly wrong to interpret this as being the time of the setting up of the abomination of desolation. Because you see that word desolation setting there, it's automatically by many assumed to mean, well, he meant the abomination of desolation. No, he did not. Because the abomination of desolation in the Hebrew is a very specific thing. Desolation is a word that you'll find throughout the Old Testament. It means when the city itself is going to be desolated. It has nothing to do with the setting up of the abomination of desolation. Luke is the only one who gives a continuous narrative where it isn't jumping back and forth. And when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, you say, well, did that ever happen? I bow before God, stand before man, and tell you it certainly did. Cestius, a Roman general, came down before Titus. He came down before Titus, and he completely encircled the city of Jerusalem. He encircled it, and he sat there for several days. They kept waiting for him to attack. He could have conquered the city. Jerusalem was not well fortified at that time. I mean, it didn't have a lot of people in it at that time, a lot of soldiers. It didn't have a lot of soldiers. They were scared to death he was going to come in, but he just kept sitting out there hoping that they'd come out and give him tribute. After he'd sat out there for quite a while, finally he just packed up and left. Well, he had a Roman legion with him, so when he took off and headed north, the people in the city said, hey, let's go out and chase him. And they went out and they chased him, and they just tore his flanks up on the army. He lost a lot of men. Well, news got back to Caesar. Caesar was furious. So Caesar then sent down Vespasian. And he told Vespasian, you go down there and you take care of those troublesome Jews around the Sea of Tiberias. And he started coming south. And then the emperor died back in Rome. And Vespasian went back to become emperor. But his son came on down. And Titus was his son, and he came down, and he conquered the city of Jerusalem, leveled it, and his troops set the temple on fire, and it burned, and he pushed every huge Herodian Ashlar off into the Tyropian Hinnom Valley, all the stones, and did exactly what Jesus had said would be done. When you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know the desolation thereof is nigh. So there were people from the first New Testament church that were in Jerusalem when this happened. There were quite a few Christians, there were quite a few church members in Jerusalem when Cestius came down and surrounded it. This is a matter of historical record. So what happened when they saw Cestius out there? Well, they were scared because they thought that's what this was, and it was. When Cestius packed up and left, they left the city of Jerusalem, and they never came back to it. So when Titus shows up a little while later on with his legion, then there weren't any Christians in the city. They'd all pulled out. Jesus, they said, Master, when shall these things be? He told them. They believed him. And when they saw the city compassed with armies, they knew what was going to happen, and they left. What did they do? Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out. He said, don't go back in the city. He said, get out of the country, for these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. All the things concerning the question that he had asked them When shall these things be? When are all the stones going to be leveled? He said, but woe unto them that are with child, them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. I've told you about this many times, and it almost makes you sick at your stomach. When Titus came down, he surrounded the city and began a siege. He kept his troops around the city. No food went in, and no food came out, and they all began to starve. It got so bad at the end of the famine that men were waiting for women to have their children, and the men would eat the woman's child. I mean, they would actually eat the newborn babe. It got that bad in this famine. And so that's why he said this. Now, what I told you is not a made-up story. This is a matter of historical record. But woe unto them that are with child, and them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. Now he tells what's going to happen when the temple will actually be leveled. He said, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations. They ask him, when shall these things be? That was the first question. The first question naturally would be, well, when's the temple going to be leveled? And he told them. Then he told them what would happen next. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles. This prophecy is about Jerusalem. It is about a city, a specific city. It is not a generalized, far-reaching prophecy. It's talking about Jerusalem. He said, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles. For how long? Until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. The fulfilling of the times of the Gentiles for Jerusalem, was June of 1967. You say, well, that's the fullness of the Gentiles. No, the fullness of the Gentiles is a different thing. The fullness of the Gentiles does not come in until the very end of the tribulation period, which is actually going to be about 3.5 years after the Antichrist attacks. It means the fullness of their wickedness has come in. And this is not what it's talking about here. The scripture over in Romans 11 has nothing to do with the times of the Gentiles being fulfilled for the Temple Mount. It has everything to do when the age of the Gentiles ends, which is when Jesus returns at the tribulation period and establishes his millennial reign over the Jewish nation. Now the next question they ask him, what signs prehail your coming? In other words, when will we know that you're coming? Luke 21 and 11. And great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines and pestilences and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven. Luke added fearful sights and great signs because Luke went ahead and went into the period that's toward the very end of the beginning of sorrows and well into the time of tribulation. He included fearful sights and great signs. The three phenomena that were to let us know that Christ's coming was near, they pre-heralded it, were earthquakes, famines, and pestilences. These are the most reliable statistics available on the surface of God's earth. They show all earthquakes greater than one across the surface of the entire earth, all the way from 1967, 68, up to the present time. You can see precisely how the number has gone up like a rocket. That's not just true with all earthquakes. It's true with each category, 4.5 to 4.9 on the Richter scale. That's middle range earthquakes. You can see how they increase just like a woman's birth pangs from 1967 up until the present time. Major worldwide earthquakes, you can see that they did exactly the same from 1967 up to the present time. This is a curve on Loimos. It has followed the exact pattern, like a woman's birth pangs. While I'm talking to you right here now, we have 36 million cases. It continues to climb. So Jesus, when he answered those questions, told us plainly, when we saw earthquakes, famines, and pestilences increasing like a woman's birth pangs, we could know that his coming was near. All right, the third question he asked was, and at the end of the age, the word for age is aeon. It means the end of time, the end of this age, the time when you establish your kingdom. Here's what he said would happen just before his coming at the end of the tribulation period. This is not what we call the rapture. This is the second advent when he comes at the end. And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars and upon the earth distress of nations. Remember what he added on to those earthquakes, famines, and pestilences that Matthew and Mark didn't put on? Fearful sights and great signs. That's what these are here. And these really don't start to click in with full validity until about the last 3.5 years of the fullness of the Gentiles, when the fullness of the Gentile age comes in. There shall be signs in the sun and the moon and the stars, and upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. Men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. For the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Verse 28. And when these things begin, I think he went all the way back to the earthquakes, famines, and pestilences. When these things begin to come to pass, when they first start, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. For 21 years I've been telling people I expected the Lord to come back for 2008. Well, no matter how many times I told them, that doesn't make it so. But I'm telling you that we're getting very, very close, and it's also about a quarter till eight. And I had some more stuff here I wanted to cover. It's pretty good stuff, but there's so much of it.